there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Hello and welcome to another episode of Words to Write By.
Hey-ya!
Before we get started, we want to talk about something that we're doing called our process group. We're reading a book right now called Bird by Bird, which is all about process. It's not about the nuts and bolts of how to put a story together. It's what kind of mindset to bring to your story. And in the spirit of this, we have started a process group through Meetup on Zoom in which people get together and we don't ask people to review our stories. We don't ask people to help us out with plot points. We just ask other people if they have any suggestions on like how to get this thing written or how to overcome this particular roadblock. And it's been really good.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of advice out there, but there's so much. How do you know which is the one that's good for you or you miss something? And what's great is you get everyone together and everyone's read different stuff. And so they'll just give you tips that you had no idea were out there. And it's like perfect. And that's exactly what you needed.
Yeah. So anyway, if you're interested in the process group, check out our website, wordstowritebypodcast.com. And at the top of the page is a really pretty graphic of a person writing that Renee did. And you click on that, it'll take you to the meetup page. And by this point, everyone knows the drill, what to do next.
I'm very proud of my graphics. They've gotten a lot better over the year and a half we've been doing this.
They really have.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we start today, I have an interview with a fiction writer. She's writing historical fiction, and as part of her story, she has gone and done some really interesting research. So I'm going to talk to her about that and some of the issues that she had and things that went really well.
Hi, I'm Katarina Hill, and I am writing a story based on the true story of my grandmother's incarceration in Connecticut, 1932, for the crimes of fornication and manifest danger.
What is the legal definition of manifest danger?
It's quite interesting. Manifest danger can be connotated two ways, that they are a manifest danger to society. And the other understanding is that they are in manifest danger of falling into habits of vice, that they are likely to be a danger. So essentially, they're incarcerating these women for something that they might do.
Okay. Before you started researching the actual facilities, the Connecticut State Farm and Prison for Women, what did you know about it?
I actually did not know a thing. I did not know that it even existed. I found out through a very long roundabout way that my grandmother was incarcerated, that my mother was in fact born in a prison. But this was 1932, it was during the Depression. And my initial feelings was, well, they were poor, they were a farm family, it's a depression, and maybe she got caught stealing. Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine that they were imprisoning women for having unmarried sex. My first realization of what was going on was when I went to visit a former warden of the facility. I saw her twice. The first time, she was very roundabout and very upbeat and really saying that this was a facility that was encouraging women to improve themselves, to better their lives. It wasn't until I saw her a second time when she told me that these women were really being incarcerated because chances are they had a venereal disease and they were a threat to society.
Did the story change? Was the story going to be something different before you talked to this woman?
It was very much going to be another story. Initially, I decided that I wanted to write this for my family. My mother is now 90. And I've got granddaughters and I've got nieces. And then my mother was a part of this unknown piece of American history and intrigued me. And I really wanted the girls in my family to know what my grandmother had endured. But after I found out why they were incarcerated and how they were incarcerated, they were summarily given a 3-year sentence, just pumping out 3-year sentences with no defense. That's when it changed for me, because my first interview with the warden, as I said, she sugarcoated everything that was happening. She didn't tell me the whole story. I had also come to learn that people like Margaret Sanger and Eleanor Roosevelt, the suffragettes of the time, fully endorsed this program. And the more that I dug, the more I understood the nature that they were afraid of these women, and really is the reason that they were locked up.
So you'd had one interview with her, which was nice and pleasant, and everybody felt really good. And then you realized that there was more to the story. Were you nervous about asking this woman for a second interview that was probably going to be more antagonistic, possibly?
I was. I came loaded for bear with my questionings. Now, she was the first female warden of a facility in the state of Connecticut. Tough old bird. She was, I think, 96 when I interviewed her the first time. She lived well into her early hundreds. But I was afraid of her not being forthcoming. Mm-hmm. And actually, she didn't tell me everything. I asked her some point blank questions. And one of them was there forced sterilization of the women? And she emphatically said, absolutely not. When indeed they absolutely were. In fact, my grandmother was one of the women who was forcibly sterilized. So I was a little bit nervous going in because she's quite a strong force. But I also knew by then I had to take whatever she said with a grain of salt.
I'm guessing that your story obviously had a warden of the prison. And in some ways, that you talked to the actual person that was in charge. How does that affect writing historical fiction?
Well, it was amazing that it was a completely female-run facility. There were no men on the property at all. Had to change my whole idea of what a prison was. This was a prison farm. It was a working farm. These women survived on everything that they produced, everything they grew. They even butchered their own meat. I think the hardest part was trying to balance that I believe that their intent was good. I believe their intent was good, but it didn't turn out that way. The trauma that these women endured lasted generations. And I think that's where my mind really shifted, was when I started understanding what these women went through. It put a big spin on my story, on the trauma, the generational trauma. And the other thing is the women who supported each other, and it was a camaraderie. They were a team. The women worked together and they survived with the help of each other through their 3-year terms.
What other sources did you go to for information about this period? This is like almost 100 years in the past at this point.
I think the one thing that really helped me a lot, and I would encourage other writers of historical fiction, is look in the bibliography of the books that you're looking at. Even when you're reading articles online, when you're spending all your time Googling, and writing historical fiction, we spend as much time researching the little tiny minutiae as we do anything. Look at the bibliographies, look at the blurbs. You will find a wealth of information on your topic. And that is how I found a fellow by the name of Scott Stern, who wrote a book. It was actually his doctoral thesis. And through Scott, he turned me on to how I found my grandmother's prison records. And it was actually my grandmother's prison records that affected me the most. The prison records are the golden egg. This was my grandmother, and I knew her just as Grandma. In fact, Grandma never told anyone that she had endured this sentence. Not my mother. None of us knew. There's an awful lot of heaviness and sadness. And therein lies part of the problem when you're writing a story. No one wants to live in that darkness for 350 pages, trying to find the light, trying to find the sunshine in a story like this. was the hard part, but everything to me had an importance, and it does.
Now, you actually went and visited the facility that the story takes place in. Tell me about that.
It was the warden who took me to the facility. The first time I met her, we went for coffee and we had the light and an airy discussion, and she took me to the facility, which has now been replaced by a new modern prison for women in her name, the York Correctional Facility in Lyme, Connecticut. But she showed me where her house was, the superintendent's house. She showed me the chapel where some of the young ladies got married on the facility. She showed me where the collection of dormitories, or cottages as they call them. And it felt good. I thought that it would be upsetting, but it felt good. I felt connected to the story. And that was the first time I think that I decided that, no, this story is not just for my family. This story needs to be told.
Is there anything that you wished you would have done differently when you were doing your research, or anything that, like, opportunity missed that you wish you would have taken?
Yes. This is my first piece of creative writing. And I wish I had all the information first. I wish I had my grandmother's prison records first. I wish I knew that they had her scrubbing the floors at 8.5 months pregnant in the facility. I wish I had her letters going back and forth to the family to know what was in her daily life. The information that I got in my research came in dribs and drabs, really, over the course of probably 2 years. The mistake that I made was writing to catch up with the information that I found rather than the other way around.
Were you nervous about approaching people with your questions?
I found it fascinating that people didn't believe what I was saying. When I started talking about this scheme, this government scheme called the American Plan, people weren't familiar with it and they found it hard to believe. And most of the time people would say, "In what country is this?" USA. And what year is this? It's 1932. So I wasn't nervous about talking to people. I think I was nervous about the reaction that people would give on why my grandmother was in prison. She was in prison because she was pregnant, because she had unmarried sex. And I think I was nervous about the judgment that would lay on her head for her actions, as we still, quite frankly, see today how women are judged on their sexual behavior.
This is a fascinating interview, both for the subject and for also your approach, because there's the professional writers that have been trained to do this. They can say, "I want to talk to you." I was like, "Oh yeah, I want to talk to you." And then there's everyone else is like, "Well, I have this idea for a story. Maybe you could help me."
It's all in the research. It's making a story out of your research, right? It still has to be a story. So you can have fun. You can brighten up that darkness with your story.
Thank you so much. This has been a fascinating interview.
Thank you, Kim.
And when your book comes out, I am totally reading it.
And you are totally getting a copy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay. On with Lamont.
On with Lamont. We are now on the next two chapters. And in fact, this will end part one.
Writing. So by the time we get to this, we should be all done with the writing. And kind of wonder why over half the book is devoted to something other than writing, but I guess we'll get to that next time.
Right, right. Part two is called The Writing Frame of Mind. So I guess the first part is about the actual doing of it, and the next part is the thinking about it.
So page 80 to page 88.
Nope. Page 85 to page 94.
Well, different editions. But yeah. Anyway, we're talking about a very short number of pages here, but a lot of content, especially in this first chapter, plot treatment.
Yeah, this one, I get the feeling this is a very valuable thing to do, but it's so big. The task is quite large.
But before we get into the meat of the chapter, at the very beginning, it talks about how everyone I know flails around kvetching and growing despondent on the way to finding a plot and a structure that works. And so my first question before we start is, what is plot and what is structure? Let's get some definitions.
Oh boy, this is fun. So one book we might review in the future. It's a very short book. It's by Alan Moore.
Alan Moore writes a short book?
He did. It's on craft. It was a series of essays that he wrote. It's pretty good. And he talks about the difference between plot and story. And so I think perhaps that is the same thing here. Plot and structure.
Nope, not exactly.
You don't think so?
You want to give me the definition first?
Well, when I hear her read plot and structure, I'm thinking plot is theme and, you know, the inner workings of people. Structure is the order in which things happen. Am I wrong?
Well, according to Bard, my AI chatbot.
Oh,
yes.
God, chatty. Oh, Bard. Wait, Bard is the Google one?
Yeah, it has less people on it. I kind of like it. It never kicks me out. Anyway, I asked Bard, and it told me that plot is the sequence of events that make up the story, while structure is the way those events are arranged.
Wait, repeat that.
Plot is the sequence of events that make up the story. So that's when the hurricane hits the house, or the person gets a job, or you have an argument. That's the plot. And the structure is the way those events are arranged. Like, okay, when you get it. Is it in a flashback? Is it in a linear sequence? Are we jumping back and forth?
I see.
So that's what she's talking about here. What happens in the book is your plot. And the order you read it in is the structure.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. I'm on board with that. Okay. Alan Moore talks about plot and story. And for him, plot includes all the themes and what the story is about. But story is just the stuff that happens. I think I've seen it defined that way in other ways. Maybe on the website, I'll throw on our show notes the different ways that authors have talked about the definition of plot and story and the difference. Because I've heard it in different veins.
Right. And the thing is, you can read through it and you pick the definition that works for you and go forward.
Yeah, just whatever works.
But I think this definition I have pretty much matches what Anne Lamont had experience. And so this chapter plot treatments is written as a story.
Yes.
It's written as a rolling disaster story. How awful it was for Anne Lamont to finish her second book.
Right. One thing I thought about is the very beginning, she talks about how when you start out, you're about to jump in the game and start writing the book, and you get an image of your head of the writer, the one that just knocks that shit out. You sit at the table, you've got the keyboard, you start typing. Do you ever have that image in your head? Like, that should be the writer that you are. Does that, like, create a hang-up for you?
No, not a hang-up. But I will say every time I sit down to write, like, moments before I actually sit down to write, when it's all in my head and all perfect, I have that momentary flash. And then my butt connects with the chair, and the pen goes to my hand, and I look at the paper or I look at the keyboard and I realize, nope, it's going to be hard.
Yep.
But we've actually talked about this. Writing is hard. It takes effort. It's not going to come easy all the time. And that's what all the shitty first drafts and short assignments and all that stuff at the beginning of the book was about.
That's why there's so many writing craft books.
Exactly. And that's why they all start off with how to get yourself writing.
Right.
So Anne Lamont, in this chapter, describes basically the five drafts that she had of this novel and what was wrong with them at each point and what she fixed with them at each point. And I thought it was fascinating to look at this progression. Because this is more than just like, how do I get the words on the page? Or how do I make myself come back to the writing system every time? How do I deal with myself sucking? This is like big picture stuff.
It's nice to read that somebody who was already successful and already published went through such a shitty time. Sorry, Lamont. But it was nice to read that somebody else went through bloody hell to get a book written.
She definitely gives the, you know, this is how bad it felt when it got rejected all those times. So she had various setbacks along the way. And I want to talk about each of the drafts and what went into it. So the first is how she started writing. This is the stuff we were talking about before. How do you get that first draft out? And so what she says is that you start off with the scene in your head that you want to work to.
It's a temporary destination, she called it.
Yeah, but in your mind, it's the culmination of this book. It's the ending. It's that thing you're waiting to actually see. And it makes all the writing up to that point, if not worth it, at least something that is going to have a payoff.
And she says, so you write towards the scene, but when you get there, or close, you see that because of all you've learned about your characters along the way, it no longer works. The scene may have triggered the confidence that got you to work on your piece, but now it doesn't ring true, and so it does not make the final cut.
Right. And that's a big disappointment. I mean, you've been working all this way, and suddenly that doesn't work. And it's not because it was a bad idea to start off with, but because you've learned so much about your characters. You've learned so much about this world. You've come up with so many wonderful things that it's not good enough for what you've written.
Right. And this is kind of the story of that. I went through this process with my second novel where an image kept me going while I came to have a strong sense of the people I was writing about. Yet when it was that climactic image's turn on the dance floor, it was all wrong.
But that's just the first stage of this. Because what happened was she realized herself that it wasn't working.
Right.
And then she said she spent 2 years getting it right.
Yeah.
So that's 2 years. Basically, she had her shitty first draft and she spent 2 years getting it to not be shitty. And she loved it. It was fantastic.
Right.
So that's the first stage. That's draft one and draft two. What I love about this book isn't just the lows when things don't work out, but obviously how excited she was to get it. And instead, she got back a letter from an editor that went, "This is perhaps the hardest letter I've ever had to write." And she read it in the post office too. She didn't go home and look at it. She's so excited to hear all the wonderful praise she was going to get. Basically, the problem with the book at this point was it was a big mess.
Right. She said, "I had in effect created a beautiful banquet, but never invited the reader to sit down and eat. So the reader went hungry." Damn.
The thing is that she thought she got it all. She was happy with it.
And the editor said, "Oh, you should just start another book from scratch."
It was that bad, folks.
Damn. Can you imagine, like, investing 2 years of your life? And you've been sending it to an editor this whole time, too. She said, "Sending it off chunk by chunk to my editor at Viking." That's another discussion, that she has access to an editor chunk by chunk through a draft. Like, that's kind of crazy.
Well, she's on her second book.
I sent her an advance.
Yeah, so she got an advance for the book. She's writing this book. That's the other issue. Like, not only is it her ego on the line, but, you know, we got hard cash that she's living off of.
Right, and she's already spent most of it.
Right, so there's a financial motivation here. So she was miserable about it, and she had a friend that said, "Okay, just put the book away."
Right.
"And come back to it."
She took 2 weeks off and went on a little retreat without writing, just to chill.
And then she came back, and she decided it was worth writing. "I licked my wounds for a couple of weeks and waited for my confidence to return. I tried not to make any big decisions about how to salvage the book or my writing life, because the one thing I knew for sure was that if I want to make God laugh, tell her your plans. And finally, I found myself ready to look at the book again. I read it through in one sitting and loved it. I thought it was wonderful. A huge mess, granted, but a wonderful mess." So the first thing she did was she went back and she reread it and decided it was worth working on.
Right. Then she calls her editor and says, "I'm going to make this work." And he's like, "All right, go for it."
And that's when she had the huge dilapidated house with the living room floor that she printed out 300 pages. And so just for clarity, when you buy a ream of paper from Office Max, that's 500 pages. So think a little more than half of that is what she printed out. They were single-sided and she laid them down page by page across the floor like dominoes or a winding garden path.
And some of them were like 2 pages, some were 10-page passages, whatever. But she laid them down on a path from beginning to end.
Uh-huh. I wanted to back up a second. I think that from the first to the second draft, she worked on the plot. And then in this thing, she's looking at structure. Because she knows what the plot of the story is, but she doesn't know how to present it to the readers to make it dramatic, to make it engaging.
Right. And then she put things together, she paperclipped stuff together, she looked for things that were missing, like transitions, vital information we needed to know before what happened could make any sense. And then on a blank piece of paper, I blocked in what I thought was needed.
Like, I'm not writing anything new, I'm just like writing little notes of stuff that I'm going to put. And then she put it all together and that's what she worked from. And I did something similar to this with my novel. And we did it on retreat too, although I did not have a whole living room to do this in. Retreat spaces here are a little bit smaller. I did my note cards. And what I did was I printed up everything and I went through chapter by chapter, scene by scene. Sometimes I found sequels and I wrote out what was in each of those. And I did it very Bickham style. I wrote what the scene goal was, what the disaster was, what the various arguments inside them were, any other notes about things that I wanted to have happen.
We have show notes on that, and I'll link those into our show notes there so you can find old episodes of how we describe what goes in those note cards that Bickham talked about.
Mm-hmm. And it was really useful. And I've got the stack here in my writing space, and I've been going through it, and it's quite satisfying as I get further and further along. I have less and less of a stack. Also, as I go further and further along, I have less and less information I'm sticking to because I'm coming up with other stuff. I'm running into the situation where she did with her second draft, where like as I develop stuff, things get moved around.
Right.
Plot points get moved in different spots and that changes the structure. And so at this point, I'm in the upper 20s chapters of a 38 chapter book. And like the note cards are more just hand waving at this point. But this is what she did. And then she took all her notes and she went through in a linear manner, and she just saw what she had to do for each section. And she treated it as short assignments where basically she just wrote what needed to be written for those bits.
Yeah, and there's that chapter, like in the beginning, short assignments, that's probably like chapter 2. Mm-hmm. She talked about short assignments in chapter 2. We have show notes on that too.
So the result then is she had the book in 3 chunks. Okay, so she worked on it for 8 to 9 months, sending off the first third, which my editor was amazed by, and then the second section, which he loved. And then I sent the third section, and then she goes into some relationship issues she had. But her plan was to show up in New York with him having all the sections, and they would just go through line edits, and it'd be this wonderful situation. Like, because, you know, she was the kind of author that can fly to New York and hang out with her editor.
She borrowed $1,000 from her aunt. Thank you, Lamotte's aunt. That was very sweet of you. And then she goes, everyone would be so shocked to hear that this book had almost been thrown away. But my editor said, I'm sorry. I am so, so sorry, she said, but it still doesn't work. Boo, poor Lamotte.
He said to phone him the next day. I said I would, although I did not actually expect to be alive then. Luckily, I was still drinking at the time.
And she did the merest bit of cocaine.
That's crazy. Good times,
I guess.
If it beat suicide, but like, yeah.
Sure.
So this is, let's imagine this. Like, you've had a rejection, but you fixed it. You did all this work. You came up with a structure. You laid it all out. People liked it. You went on through, and it still doesn't work. And the question is, why?
Yeah, why?
What do you think?
I think she's implying it was structure. That it wasn't so much story, but that it was structure. Why doesn't it work? I'm not sure why her story didn't work.
I'm imagining this is like one of those books that you pick up and you read the beginning and it's amazing. And you keep going and you're liking how it's going. It's coming along and there's maybe some things, but you're still going on. And you get to the final page and you realize, it wasn't that good. Like, do you ever have books like that where you're excited at the beginning, you feel like you're enjoying the reading, you get to the end, and then it just doesn't have the payoff?
Yeah, I've read some, like, experimental books that way.
Okay, but how about, like, some of the books that you read for your book club? Because you don't like all those books.
No, I do not like all of those books. Well, actually, here we go. Here's one book. Oh, damn, what was the name of it?
Sunshine?
Oh, God. I've already talked about that book. Everyone knows how I feel about that one. The book was... Okay. I believe it was called The Memory Police. And it's totally up my alley, man. They get describe it. We all pick it. I am on board. And I start reading. It is fascinating. It is a cool plot. There's a police state. And the police state just decides that something disappears. And magically, that thing gets disappeared. They call it getting disappeared. It gets disappeared out of people's brains. It's like they know there was something there, but they don't quite remember it. It's very 1984.
So in this book,
yeah,
you loved it. It was your jam.
Man.
You loved it. You're reading along. What happened?
Nothing. It set itself up for this really cool plot about this police state controlling everything, like V for Vendetta or whatever. And it just sort of just ended like, meh,
Did anything happen to the protagonist at the end? Was she in a safe place or a bad place?
She forgot herself.
Okay.
The book group decided that it was one big metaphor for dementia or Alzheimer's. She herself disappeared. She was like a speck on the wall, or she lived in the keyhole or something. And it was like, I like that as long as that metaphor is clear.
Yeah.
But if it's not, it's just kind of like this person did not know how to end the book. And I guess it wants us to feel the ambiguity. And sometimes that's okay. But the ambiguity, it was so ambiguous that I felt like this author themselves did not know how to end the book.
Yep. And I think this is what Lamont's talking about here. I don't think it was pretentious or anything else. It was that second thing. It was just like the end of the book, and it just didn't go where you thought it was supposed to go. And so what happens is after she sobers up, I called my editor home. He was not planning on going to work that day. He was a little depressed too. "I'm coming over," I said. And there was a silence. And then he said very tentatively, "Okay." Like he wanted to ask, "And will you be bringing knives?"
I did that to my ex once.
We're talking a little different situation here. But basically, what happened was they had a back and forth of why the story wasn't working. And all those things you said about this story that you read, the
memory police.
The memory police. He went and said, "Well, it just doesn't work because of this," or "I don't understand this." And she's like, "Well, it's because of this and this. And this is because this is." And he went through the whole thing. And at the end, he said, "Thank you." And he said, "Listen, I want you to write that book that you just described to me. You haven't done it here. Go off someplace and write me a treatment, a plot treatment. Tell me chapter by chapter what you just told me in the last half hour, and I will get you the rest of the advance." So I'm thinking about this process where she is explaining to her editor what's going on, explaining why she's doing these things, explaining all these things. And you know what it kind of reminded me of? Some of the stuff we do with you and your book.
My reverse outline?
No, not so much. Like, but when we sit down at a retreat and we're talking about it, and you're saying, "Well, I'm not sure if I want this or I want that, or I want this in here because of this element here."
I remember that specifically. So it was our first retreat together and we're sitting there and I'm having a hard time and I'm like, "Kim, I just need to talk this out." And so you took a break and, you know, we're having snacks and I go, "Okay, this is what's going on." Mm-hmm. And I just talked out the events going on in the story. And I talked about the themes I thought and all these things. And then you filled in a lot of these blanks. You gave your perspective on these things. And you gave me a really detailed picture of what's going on in the reader's brain. Mm-hmm. But also your just insights as a person, knowing me as a person.
This is kind of where theme starts coming in. This is kind of where the things like this critical piece of knowledge has to be conveyed to the reader at this point so they understand the importance of it. This is all the stuff you're lining up so when the dominoes all fall and you finish that last page of the book, you go, "Wow," as opposed to, "Eh."
Yeah.
Anyway, so draft 4 just didn't work. After all that stuff, it just didn't work. And so he told her to write a plot treatment. What was the plot treatment that she did?
Okay, so the plot treatment. And I actually have questions about this. "I sat down every day and wrote 500 to 1,000 words describing what was going on in each chapter. I discussed who the characters were turning out to be, where they'd been, what they were up to, and why. I quoted directly from the manuscript sometimes, using some of the best lines to instill confidence in both me and my editor. And I figured out, over and over, point A, where the chapter began, and point B, where it ended, and what needed to happen to get my people from A to B."
I mean, at this point, we're actually kind of getting into Bickham territory, aren't we?
Totally. Well, there's a reason why his book is called Scene and Structure.
Yeah.
Not Scene and Sequel, but Scene and Structure.
You know, you can go about it the way Bickham does, where you come at it with a set of scenes and a plot and all that stuff, and you work it out and you just cookie cutter it or whatever you do to get this page-turning book. Or you can do as Lamont does, where you start a lot more fuzzy with characters, interactions, and ideas of things you want to go to, and just you write it on out, and you find the beautiful stuff. But then at a certain point, if you want to make a really good book, and this apparently is like one of her best books, then you need to go bick them on the book and make sure it's a page turner and make sure it's rewarding to the person reading it and giving them all the stuff that they want to get as they're reading that book.
So essentially, she writes a character-driven novel, but then edits it for the plot, the plot-drivenness. And it's interesting, too, because I felt she had a very similar metaphor to this, this structure thing. She, like him, called it a house. So he described the structure of a novel as a house, putting in the supports of the house. And then she said the book felt like a house with no foundation, no support beams, which was collapsing in on itself, which was the problem with her draft, right? And so he talked about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. She also has a shout out after the plot treatment. The book moved along like the alphabet, like a vivid and continuous dream.
Hello, Gardner. So that was John Gardner, the continuous dream.
Yep. But she refers to that not as the book itself, but the treatment, the 40-page treatment. So she did the treatment. The editor did not want to read the entire book again and find out what was wrong with it. They wanted the plot treatment. 40 pages is a lot easier to go through on this book and tell her if it works or doesn't work.
Right.
Which is another good reason to have a plot treatment. You can probably figure out what's not working much quicker.
Right, right. And she said, this time I knew exactly what I was doing. I had a recipe.
And that's what she wrote up for the fifth book. The book came out the following autumn and has been the most successful of my novels.
It was a brave document, she said. I highlighted that because I liked that statement. Mm-hmm. That phrase.
The first read of this chapter is a lot of like, don't get discouraged. Look, it's hard for me. You're going to have to keep going back. People are going to say they don't like your novel and you're going to have to go back and you're going to have to fix it as opposed to saying that they don't know what they're talking about. And if you do this, if you keep listening, you may produce your best book ever. So there's that inspirational aspect. What I really liked about this was like the steps, like the different things she fixed and what she didn't fix, even though she thought she was fixing stuff.
Right. And it just goes completely against the idea that you're going to sit there and write a book and then it's going to be done.
Right.
Which leads us into the next chapter. How do you know when you're done? You never know. Spoiler. No, I'm just kidding. Kind of, actually. You don't really know. I mean, she sort of answers that question, but not really. This chapter is not even a, well, it's about a page long. If you typed it up, maybe it's like a page and a quarter.
I wrote that you know when it's done when you're sick and tired of it.
Yep.
Or she actually, in a more positive way, says, when you fix everything that needs fixing, when you put the octopus to bed.
Yeah.
Which, like, okay, for a metaphor. But
I think it's cute.
When you stop seeing what you need to correct, that's when it's done. Or when you think it's done, it's done. I mean, you know, it's very, very nebulous. I pointed out that often people also will finish it when they have a deadline.
Yeah. And you need money. And there's an advance on the line. And right. You need to pay your rent.
Right. So that's the other way you know it's done.
Yeah. Or when the publisher says, okay, thank you. Here's your check. So that was it. That is part one of Bird by Bird. And then next episode, we'll go digging into part two, the writing frame of mind. But until we do, we have an activity to do.
Okay. So you came up with an activity this time.
So the one I came up with was just doing a plot treatment to one chapter because, wow. Writing 40 pages. I mean, I think it's very valuable, but will I be able to do that in a week in time for us to like do our bonus episode? I don't know.
I kind of have done a plot treatment on large portions of my book.
You did those note cards.
I did the note cards.
But that's not a plot treatment. She wrote 40 pages. She didn't write note cards.
Okay, so a plot treatment on one chapter of your book, which is 500 to 1,000 words.
A chapter.
Yeah. For a chapter. But I mean, some of my chapters are only 1,600 words.
Right. So hers was a literary novel. It's probably longer. I don't know.
Okay. So like take a chunk of the book. I mean, if you're going to do 500 words, it should be at least 5,000 words that you're critiquing.
Okay.
I could do the first two chapters of my book. They fit together very well. And I could do a plot treatment. What needs to be in this plot treatment?
That was my question here. So, all right. We read that quote. One. Described what was going on. So I guess a summary of the chapter, the events occurring. Two, she discussed who the characters were turning out to be, where they'd been, what they were up to, and why. So that's four things.
I do see that if you're starting at the very beginning chapter of a book, this is going to be different than if you're doing a middle chapter of the book.
Right. And we're not done. She said,
You had to figure out point A, which is where the chapter begins. Figure out point B, where it ends. And then three, what needs to happen to get the characters from point A to point B. She even has another one we didn't talk about, which is, and then how the B of the last chapter would lead organically into the point A of the next chapter, which is so Bickham. Oh my God. Right. That's how he does it.
Yeah. How long are your chapters?
They vary. Some are like 20 pages and some are like four.
So I think I might take two chapters to do this. But we'll see. If it's a long chapter, I'll do it as a long chapter. Okay. And well, so if I were to do it as two chapters, then I probably would have a how point B from one chapter goes to point A of the next chapter too.
Now, are you going to write like prose and go through and write paragraphs, or are you going to just write notes, like make a list here and then try to like write a list, like an outline more than a?
I think I'm going to write it actually in prose, because that's part of a plot treatment, is that somebody should be able to read it without seeing a whole bunch of bullet points. It shouldn't just be the thoughts of what's on the page. It should actually be
kind of like an
full
argument.
Sentence. Yeah. It's like, you know, this is so that an editor can look at it and say this works or this doesn't work.
This is very much like a book proposal, which, dear listener, is something you would do if you didn't have an agent and you wanted to, you know, just submit your book directly to a publisher. You would write a book proposal.
Or in the case that you're writing a nonfiction book, you write a book proposal because you don't write the book until someone's willing to pay you for it. And the book proposal is everything that goes into what the book's going to be, because often, like, you need to do research or you need to find out stuff or interview people or do all this other work to figure out what's going on. And so the editor can look at the book or the agent can look at the book and say, yes, this is a solid proposal.
Yeah. Do I do the same thing then? Two chapters?
You should aim to have more than 5,000 words. And if that's a single chapter, then do a single chapter.
Okay.
Maybe a better way of saying is also your treatment should be only 10% of the words that you're going over. So oh, you man. Can't do a 2,000 word treatment of a chapter that's only 4,000, 5,000 words. It has to be, that's the other criteria, 10% of the word count in your treatment.
That's really hard. I could write twice as much.
I know. That's easier to write twice as much. I actually think what's going to be the most valuable thing for you, Renee, is writing your plot treatment at 10% the number of words.
How come?
It's easy for you to write verbosely, but the idea here is we want to see what's in that chapter and what's important.
I'm not writing verbose. It's not purple prose.
No. Verbose is different than purple prose.
No, it's not. It's the same thing. It's like pontificating.
No. I mean, verbose can be, like, here's the thing. What I would worry about you doing is writing your chapter basically as the chapter.
Okay, so I just want to say, how come these things that are good for you are painful? This is mean. It's mean. Just saying. Dear universe, you are cruel, cruel mistress.
Writing is hard. Well, Renee, you propose the activity, so let's go do it.
Damn it. What have I done? New con. All right, dear listener. This is quite the feat, but I believe that we are up to the task.
I would like also to say, I think this is actually a really good exercise for me to do, and I actually appreciate it. So,
and it just so happens, lucky me, I saw what you did on our last retreat, and Kim had printed out every one of her chapters and had them like divided with like dividers, I believe, in a notebook. And I was like, that's clever. And I did that. And now I have that all together. So it's actually kind of asking for this plot treatment.
Yep. Okay. We get to work then. Okay. We're back from our writing exercise.
We are back. This was quite illuminating.
We're going to discuss mine in this podcast, and we'll discuss Renee's in our bonus podcast. So I decided to do plot treatments for my chapter one and chapter two of my novel. These are really established chapters. I've been over them like a ton of times. I've gotten feedback. These are really solid pieces. So it wasn't too hard to summarize and go through it because everything that I wanted was there. I think you had a little different experience with yours, right, Renee?
Oh, yeah. So in our bonus podcast, you will hear about very different issues than Kim has going on, whatever, with her book. If you are writing a memoir, you really should listen to the bonus one, because the plot issue is a big issue among all people writing memoir. And this plot treatment was very illuminating for me anyway.
So when I was doing it, though, I imagined kind of being Anne Lamott and having this editor say, I just don't get this piece. I'm just not connecting with it. It just isn't doing anything for me. And her saying, no, it's really important because this is what's really going on, or this is the element that's coming into this point. And so when I was writing my piece, I was very much thinking about, like, if I were going to tell someone why this chapter was important, I really would push those pieces. So I'm going to read mine. I've been a little bit quiet about what my story is about because it's what's called a high concept story. What would you think a book that was called high concept would mean if someone said they had a high concept book?
Honestly, I would have to just like use context clues because I don't really know. Mm-hmm. So context clues would alert me to thinking a high concept book is like a hoity-toity literature kind of book with highfalutin ideas in it.
That's what I always thought too, but apparently a high concept book is something that is so dead simple that you can convey the point immediately. Like Pride and Prejudice with Zombies is a high concept book. You actually don't need to say anything more than the title when someone say, ah, it's Pride and Prejudice and there's zombies. That's the book.
Right. This is one of those well actually fact.
Yeah.
So that you can whip out during a cocktail party.
Mm-hmm. So the simpler your book is to describe, the more high concept it is. The more nuanced, like if someone's doing a high fantasy with a chosen one that has to defeat a dark lord, like that doesn't distinguish it from a whole bunch of other high fantasy. There you have to start digging deeper about what it's about, what makes it special. But if you have a high concept, it's obvious. Even if people know it's not special but stupid, they still get it. So the concept for my high concept novel.
Are you going to reveal it?
Yeah. I kind of have to.
No. Oh, wow. Dear listener, this is big. She's been working on this for a while, and we talk about it on the podcast, but she doesn't reveal. And so this is a really big moment. So if you are listening right now, prick your little ears up. Be very excited. Drum roll, please.
So my story is about a has-been boy band that gets magically teleported to a fantasy realm and goes on a Dungeons & Dragons-style adventure.
Bam. Instant success. I can't wait to read it.
So anyway, that's the premise. And my first two chapters take place in our world as the band assembles. So I'm going to be reading plot summaries. There's going to be no magic mentioned at all. So chapter one. The chapter/book opens with Kyle Moretti, a has-been boy band backup singer, showing up at a video game company to practice for a VR concert he and his bandmates will be performing to launch their band's comeback tour. Kyle is struggling with transitioning back into this world, as seen through his interactions with Mina, an assistant, and feelings of being an inadequate musician-performer, as seen from his interactions with his bandmate, Oscar Jones. Over the chapter, the reader is fed particular details of the band's formation and demise through Kyle's internalizations and a conversation with a tech guy, Dave, who Kyle thinks is a hater, but turns out to be a fan. Despite evidence supporting the band's success potential, Kyle remains doubtful, bordering on cynical, about the band's success. Peppered throughout the chapter are almost references to somebody important, somebody very much on Kyle's mind, who he avoids naming until the end of the chapter when this person, Tristan Ives, the band's breakout star, walks in. The chapter starts with Kyle being observant and passive, but with Tristan's entrance, the story clicks into the now. The reader knows that Tristan is important. His presence and actions will make Kyle react. And I've written summaries, I've written pitches for this book, I've written synopsis for the chapter, and this is very different than both of them.
So a summary is just what happens, right? Right. So how did you approach this, what did she call it? Plot treatment?
Right. What I did was I really was going for, like I'm phrasing here, I'm saying that Kyle has interactions with Mina, Oscar Jones, and Dave, and in no case do I actually say what his interactions are. Like in the case of Dave, it's somebody who he thinks is against the band but turns out to be a fan. But that's all told through a series of dialogue, and the whole backstory of the band is revealed at that section. And I don't even mention it in the plot treatment because what's important for my plot treatment is to say, okay, this is the experience that Kyle has. This is the experience the reader is going to have reading this. This person that we think doesn't like the band, but turns out to actually really like the band.
So you did summarize the chapter, but it does have a different feel to it.
Because you've read the chapter.
I have read the chapter. So, you know, the chapter comes with dialogue, slowly reveals what's going on, and then there's internal dialogue going on with the main character. It's written through that character's voice. This, though, this is a really interesting take because you're looking at the book as a book. You're like, I am touching the pages. You're not necessarily reading the words, you know, and getting the story. You're just kind of retelling it, but that would be a summary. But you're mostly focusing on what happens first, what happens last, how people are getting there, and what is going on with them as they do.
Right, and what the reader is getting out of it, too. And it's very much telling. I say, Kyle remains doubtful, bordering on cynical, about the band's chances for success. And that's something that, you know, I don't say anywhere in the... Kyle never says, I don't think we have a chance. Or he comes close to, but it's really just edged to. So it's all shown to the reader.
Right.
And what I like about this is someone read through, like when you were reading through the chapter, did you get a feel that Kyle thought the band was going to be successful?
No. He thought it was just like a weird scheme.
So it's conveyed. But let's say that I had given you this thing, given you the plot treatment, and you read it, you said, you know, I don't get the feel that Kyle thinks this isn't going to work. Then I would know, oh, this thing that I wanted to do didn't happen. I need to go back to the chapter and see all these points where Kyle might be implying that he doesn't think it's going to work.
Right.
And make sure that they're upped. So I think that's what Anne Lamott was doing with her book. She knew what all the chapters were going to be, but she was lacking maybe even a phrase or just a line that really would bring it home to the readers. And so then she knows what her chapter's supposed to do, and then she looked to see how to do it, which also is interesting because up until this point, a lot of her stuff is like, discover what's in your story, discover what's going to go on, write a whole bunch of stuff, and your subconscious will produce this wonderful piece. And this is very top-down. This chapter has to do this. Does it? No. Let's go back and rewrite it.
Right, exactly. This kind of treatment tickles my analysis brain, my literary analysis brain that I used to get through college. You know, even at one point you say the reader knows that Tristan is important mm-hmm. because of all of these things. It's almost like you're trying to prove what the themes are. I mean, you don't have dialogue or quotes, but you're stating it as almost as if it is an argument, as a matter-of-fact argument, mm-hmm. which is what she described kind of in the chapter, too.
Yeah, she's arguing for her piece. She's arguing that for this chapter that this book has meaning and is important.
One question I have is just interesting because in the chapter, I was okay with it. Like reading your chapter, I was like, okay, yeah, at the very end, Tristan shows up. That seemed like a good place for the chapter to end, mm-hmm. you know, and everything went dark and then went back up again when I got to chapter two. But in this plot treatment, if I hadn't read the chapter and I had just read the chapter starts with Kyle being observant and passive, but with Tristan's entrance, the story clicks into the now. The reader knows that Tristan is important. His presence and actions will make Kyle react. So in Lamott's description of this plot treatment, of what she did to hers, she talks about connect point A to point B. What is the beginning of the chapter? What is the end? What needs to happen to get your characters from point A to point B. It doesn't talk about, I don't know if it needs to, but it doesn't quite talk about how it gets us there. I mean, I guess it does in the beginning. You say the game company to practice for a VR concert. He and his bandmates will be performing to launch their band's comeback tour. Okay. But then the point B is what's confusing me. Mm-hmm. Point B is just the reader will know Tristan is important. Mm-hmm. Tristan walks in. So the beginning is point A, the setup, mm-hmm. why they're all there for this VR comeback tour thing. Mm-hmm. And it ends with Tristan showing up. I don't know. I mean, it works in the chapter. I was fine with that. And it's not like this plot treatment isn't just revealing everything that's happening, because that's totally what happens. But it does deflate, you know, how that chapter is ending. If I was like, well, if I'm only looking at point A and point B, some dude shows up.
Right. I think this chapter does have that feel. It's like there's a lot of information I need to convey in my story. And so I was really taking my time. Initially, when I wrote the book, my first draft, everything was compacted into like a paragraph, and then I jumped right into the fantasy world and all the stuff, and I filled it in, and people were not able to follow it. There were too many characters. There was too much like references of stuff they didn't know. And so I slowed it down. I stuck it in the real world, and I slowly introduced each of the characters and gave them enough time to get to know who they were and what they thought and what Kyle thought about them. The result is that not much happens as far as Kyle's movement. Kyle's movement in the story is to go to the games company and come up to the studio and see his friend Oscar and talk to Dave and witness Tristan coming in. And there's very little building blocks where one thing leads to another. And it's a very tight time frame.
It is. Just by reading this, and I do think the chapter works on its own, but just by reading this, I would almost think that there might be a more dramatic point B. Because it's clearly leading us up to the next chapter, because, you know, Tristan shows up. What's going to happen with Tristan? Obviously, we're going to the reader question in the right next chapter. It's great. But if I was just reading this and not the other thing, I would say make it a little more dramatic. Like, maybe Kyle is talking smack about Tristan behind his back and is in the middle of a joke.
Mm.
And then Tristan shows up and hears the joke.
Mm-hmm. But you know, actually, plot treatments are really bad for this kind of analysis. Like, synopsises are really good because it says this happens, this happens, this happens. A plot synopsis is really good for identifying when stuff isn't working. But for a plot treatment, you have to trust that the person knows what they want, because you don't tweak the plot treatment and say, oh, it's not dramatic enough, you should add this other thing. Because the plot treatment really is what the audience is supposed to get out of it. And if what I just want is a surprise when Tristan walks in, I don't want a conflict. I don't want Kyle to be embarrassed. Somebody reading the chapter could say, you know, it needs more energy in here. You need to rejigger this or change the structure or do something. But I don't know if you can really say that from the plot treatment.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah, so this is the thing. Okay, so I'm not sure. Like, the difference between a synopsis and a plot treatment.
I find plot synopsis to be fairly boring.
It's like a summary?
Yeah, and it's... A synopsis is usually one or two pages, so you can sit down, you can read the entire synopsis, you know how it's going to end, you know what the climax is going to be, you know all that lineup, and you can say, ah, this is an actual story, as opposed to some things that probably peter out and really don't go anywhere at a certain point.
That's true. Like, you could summarize the entire chapter in a sentence.
Yeah.
But here, like, how many words, how small did you get this compared to the size of your chapter?
It's about 200 words, and the chapter's about 2,500 words.
Okay.
So less than 10%.
Less than 10%. Okay. Did you find this helpful for you? Like, did you get anything out of this process of writing this?
Like I said, this is a fairly worked over chapter. And what I liked about it was it did put clearly in my mind what important stuff I wanted in my chapter. But I was working from looking at the chapter, which I knew really well, and I was just telling someone what was the really important stuff in the chapter. So it wasn't a discovery, and it didn't show me anything that was missing.
If you did this to, like, a middle chapter that you're still working on, would you gain more insight?
I think I probably would. Or if I'd written the entire first draft or a second draft, and I was just getting feedback from the readers that they just were kind of getting bored in the middle, then a plot treatment would be a really good thing to sit down and do and figure out what things I thought I was putting in the middle that maybe the readers didn't get.
I think it's important to note for the listeners that are going to join us on Patreon for our bonus episode, only $3 a month, dear listener. So Kim has been working on this book for a long time. She's really worked on those chapters a lot. So, I mean, I don't know if you wrote this from just memory or if you even had to look at your chapter at all, but it does feel very solid. Even the plot treatment seems very solid, and it does do all of the things that it says that it does. So you didn't put anything new in there.
Right.
You were reacting to something that's already done, really. Mm-hmm. Whereas mine, it relies on would-haves. It relies on, because there's so many issues going on with my chapter and I've been beating my head against the wall with it, that I had to change the questions a bit, right? Instead of who are the characters, I had to write, who do the characters want to be?
Mm.
Right? Instead of saying, you know, where is point A? mine is more like, where is point A now that I know what I know and where it should start now that I'm writing this thing? And so it's very different.
Well, I think we will leave the rest of the conversation for the Patreon account. Thank you all for listening. If you want to support this podcast, you can go over to Apple Podcasts or whatever you listen to the podcast on and leave us a review. We would really like some more reviews. Most of our reviews are from 2022, and I think a couple of 2023s would look really good there.
Yeah, that would be really nice. And we'll do a little shout out if it's nice.
Yeah,
we'll do a little shout out for you. And we have different tiers on Patreon, so go check us out.
Okay. Well, thank you guys so much for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks. See ya.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
And we didn't have smartphones back then and Google in our pocket. And you know what? Bitch was wrong. You can have identical triplets. Ruined his workshop. I was so mad.